in. However, I want to introduce Charlie Finch. I've asked Charlie Finch to use the format of an interview with Richard Johnson, who's filling in for us this evening, as he does on the radio. Charles Finch is host on the program Art Breaking, Thursday afternoons from 3 to 4 p.m. It's on WBAI FM station 99.5. Good plug for you, Charlie.
Thank you very much, Ann. As Ann said, I'm the host of Art Breaking, which you can hear from 3 to 4 p.m., 99.5 FM on WBAI every Thursday. I've tried to have it piped into the club, but have not been successful so far. Mr. Francis Thorne has been a guest on my show, and he will be a guest on my show again on March the 5th. I'm also starting a syndicated national show next month with Fox Broadcasting, and it's my hope to use the tape of this show as the initial show for that show. Thank you all for coming tonight. I'm overwhelmed being in this beautiful room, which I remember being in as a young man in my debutante days. I have many fond memories. And my guest tonight is Richard Johnson, probably the dean of all columnists in New York City. He is a daily columnist, of course, for the New York Daily News. He had a regular art column for Connoisseur magazine. Unfortunately, Connoisseur appears to have folded, but it caused a lot of excitement in a short run. During the go-go 1980s, Richard Johnson edited Page Six for the New York Post. He's also had a column for the New York Observer in the past and was a producer for Previews, a television show. Richard, glad to have you here.
Good to be here.
These handheld mics are a little different than we have on the radio station, so I hope you'll bear with us. Usually in the radio station, the mics tend to come up like this. Can you hear us, though, in the back, I hope? Excellent. Well, Richard, you recently ran an item about Robert Maxwell, and there have been many theories about how Mr. Maxwell died or whether, if in fact he did die, but tell us this latest theory.
Yeah, well, my favorite theory, although it's not one that I believe, is that he's having lunch with Elvis down in Argentina. But as much as some of us may want to believe that, I think that he is in fact dead. There were pictures in Paris Match that looked quite like him. Pictures of the autopsy table. And so I think that he is dead, but I think that there's still a lot of speculation over how he may have met his end, because it's just from the facts as they were presented, you know, the guy falls off a boat. It's very hard for a man who's about 300 plus pounds to slip under, you know, roll off a boat, you know, because it was this large boat with railings and stuff.
But isn't there?
It's hard to even to imagine him going over a railing. You know, how do you get the low center of gravity up above?
But isn't there a theory that Mikhail Gorbachev's agents may have preceded his demise?
So the original theory that I thought was perhaps because he had just been linked in a book by Anthony Sampson, he had been linked to the Israeli Secret Service, Mossad, so I thought that it was perhaps Palestinian frogmen had slipped aboard the boat, and he was a victim of that kind of a plot. But the latest information I have, which is complete rumor, unsubstantiated, but it was repeated by somebody who might know something somewhere. You know, in other words, it's good, solid, fifth-hand information. was that he was good friends with Mikhail Gorbachev, and that is known that they had dealings together in Moscow, and Maxwell used to visit him. And so the theory goes is that he was making some investments for Maxwell of Maxwell's private money, which perhaps he shouldn't have even had, but. Maxwell made these investments, and then Gorbachev asked for his money back, and Maxwell couldn't produce it, and so Gorbachev sent a couple of large men, maybe from the KGB, to persuade him to expedite the matter. And at that point, after he starts pushing Maxwell around, he has a heart attack, and then they choose to throw him overboard.
Richard, you came on board the Daily News. You came on board the Daily News when Bob Maxwell took over the paper, and you went to the Gridiron Dinner with him in Washington and met President Bush and General Schwarzkopf. What were your impressions of him as a man?
Well, my impression, I first heard that he was missing at sea. It seemed inconceivable to me that he would commit suicide, because he seemed like a person who had already gone bankrupt a couple times, who had changed his name a couple times, and he seemed like the sort of person where, disaster, he would thrive. He sort of enjoyed the struggle, and he would have enjoyed, like Trump sort of enjoyed, all the press about his downfall. I think that... But I couldn't see him committing suicide. But then, it got worse as the news leaked out. And then you discovered that $1 billion of pension funds were missing in London, and then you started to think that it was perhaps possible. But even then, I thought this is the sort of man who had an ego that he would write. If he did leave, he would have left at least a 200-page suicide note. So,
did he monitor your columns day to day and offer his criticisms?
I think he was like a lot of these wheeler-dealer types. He had a very, very short attention span. I think he would come in and he'd buy something like the Daily News, and he would have a flurry of activity, and then he'd go off and wouldn't pay attention to it at all. I never had any feedback at all on a personal level from Mr. Maxwell.
Connoisseur magazine just went belly up, like Bob Maxwell. After a 90-year history, and it was surprising because Hearst Publications, which has deep pockets, had hired Gail Love, an esteemed and hardened editor, to edit the magazine and launched a public relations campaign, and indeed hired Richard Johnson to write their Art World column. Richard, why and how did Connoisseur fail?
Well, I think it was a question of money. I think that they had already spent in the years, since buying, it was an English magazine, and then they bought it about 10 years ago, and I don't think it had ever made money. And they had, invested a lot over the years to try to build it up into something, and in nothing, it wasn't working. I was surprised that they pulled the plug so quickly on Gale, because they just sort of revamped it, and less than a year later. In other words, usually somebody who goes into a project like that, they have a plan, and they'll give it like 2 or 3 years, because it's very hard for a magazine to start and immediately. Like Vanity Fair, it took like 7 years or something before they were successful.
And indeed, in 84 and 85, under the previous editorship, Vanity Fair was considered a failure before Tina Brown took over.
Absolutely. But even after she took over, it took 4 years to make, before they started making money.
To review some of the items that you've introduced in Connoisseur in the last year, you had an item about Martha Graham's estate. Perhaps you could tell us about that. Forgive me, I was just saying to Mr. Johnson that he had written about Martha Graham's estate. There's a dispute over the late Martha Graham's estate and her collection of artworks.
Well, that was a situation where Martha Graham basically left her entire estate to this man, Ron Protas, who had been, her companion and her right hand for 30 years or so. And I guess there was some dissatisfaction among people in the dance company who felt that everything should have been left to the dance company, because if this guy decides, I'm sick of this modern dance and decides to take off for Mexico or Brazil, he could just cash in all of his chips and split, and they'd be left high and dry. So I think that was basically the situation. She had some very valuable, some sculptures made by Noguchi as basically as stage props. And there's a question, though, over how much they're worth. I mean, even though Noguchi was a great sculptor and his artworks are worth a lot, these are things that are made out of paper mache or very disposable sort of materials, and so it's not known if they're worth as much as something that was carved out of granite. So, but I think that sort of whenever something like that happens and there's a change of the guard, you have some people who are sort of put out.
Do you find that with the bad economic times that wealthy collectors are trying to unload their collections very quickly now and finding no buyers?
I think that's what happens. I mean, the people who aren't desperate, though, they'd be crazy to sell when the market's down. You know, they wait until it comes back up again. But you do find some people. I mean, I was amazed when Liz Taylor tried to sell, I think it was a Van Gogh recently, and it didn't meet the upset price. She wanted like $20 million for it. And I thought, this is very strange that somebody would try to sell a painting of this sort at this time, because it's like, obviously, there's the wrong time to try to sell something.
Well, most Van Goghs are considered to be immune from being bought in, but it was a surprise that this picture was bought in. You also write in Connoisseur, in this month's issue, the last issue of that esteemed magazine, that Robert Gottlieb, the editor of The New Yorker, who is famous for collecting handbags, has... And you know, Robert and his companion published an article in New York Magazine 5 years ago. They collect mid-50s handbags, and they have them in Bob's apartment on glass shelves. They're trying to monopolize the handbag market, but he's also broadened his collection, yes? He's collecting something new.
Well, these aren't just like any old handbags. These are plastic handbags from the 50s. It's not like crocodile or alligator or something nice. These are pure plastic. But now the latest thing that he seems to be getting into is platform shoes from the 70s.
And how, is there a provenance in platform shoes for the 70s?
Well, the best pair that I ever saw was in a movie called I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, where there was actual live goldfish swimming in the platform shoes, and I thought if you were going to start a collection, that was that'd be the one I would start with.
Bob Gottlieb has taken the New Yorker in some radical directions, including the use of four-letter words in the magazine, a lot more illustrations up front, and hidden nightlife columns in the front of the book. You think he's doing a good job?
I don't find that people read it is, I mean, it used to be almost anyone's house you went to, it was on the coffee table. And then there was the question, well, are they just putting it on the coffee table, or are they actually reading it? And it was never clear to me. But it used to be, I would see it more often than I do now. But I think that maybe, you know, maybe he's getting a harder core readership, you know, with more loyal readership or something. It's lost its cachet as the thing to have on the coffee table, I think.
To switch the subject to a more serious note, Tina Chow, who was a big social mover and shaker in Manhattan during the 80s, recently died in Los Angeles of AIDS. Her husband, of course, ran Mr. Chow's restaurant. Has this sent shockwaves through New York society that a woman this prominent would die of this disease in such a public manner?
Well, I think what it does is it just makes people wonder, because it came out in the obituaries that this is a woman who said before she died that she had contracted the disease heterosexually, but then it never sort of named who might have given it to her or something. So it raised a question, and then also she had been separated from her husband for many years and had been linked with several other people. So raises a whole question about her, the whole circles that she was associated with and everything. And so I learned after I did my story that Vanity Fair is now pursuing the story, and that a reporter named Maureen Orth was out on the West Coast last week, even as my story was appearing, and she was tracking down various leads there.
It used to be said by straight people such as ourselves in New York that as long as prominent women were not in the obituaries, that we would feel safe. This doesn't appear to be the truth anymore, does it?
Well, yeah, but she's like one. There's very hard to find other examples. And then also, you never know. I mean, people say that they get it heterosexually, but maybe she was doing something else. Who knows?
I should say that Richard Johnson, in addition to all his other skills, is a demon bridge player. And you can call him at 210-6321 because he finds it amongst his friends that it's very difficult to get up a game. Isn't that true?
It's very difficult.
Have you played bridge all your life?
No, just since I was about 12.
Well, that's close enough. And how would you rate yourself in skill?
Well, I've never played for big stakes, so I think I'm, you know, intermediate.
You know, my family...
I've forgotten how to play the Stamen Club Convention, so maybe I'm back to beginner now.
My family is full of Demon Bridge players, but I unfortunately am not one of them, and my mother has tried to explain it to me many times, and I just, my eyes glaze over. So I salute you all. I hear it's the greatest game there is. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. I'd rather play bridge for free than to play poker for money, even if I was winning.
Let's talk about the presidential race, Richard Johnson. It seems that Bill Clinton, with all the rumors about his extramarital affairs, the draft, whether or not he appointed Jennifer Flowers to a state position, that he seems to be gaining strength from this. Is that your sense of what's going on?
Well, there's a theory that the Democrats have sort of a death wish. You know, they seem to have a record of picking candidates which will self-destruct. So it sort of fits the pattern over the years, you know, from Eagleton to everyone.
Did you feel, as a daily columnist in a New York newspaper, pressure to find items about him? You've done a number of items about him.
No, not at all. I just think that, you know, it's an election year. We're bound to do items about whoever's, you know, you're going to do more items about front runners than you are about Tsongas, although now I guess he's a front runner.
You know, I had Frank DiGiacomo, who edits Page 6 of the New York Post, on my radio show 3 weeks ago, who was a protege of Richard Johnson's. And he said it was his impression that President Bush has actually been very ill for the last couple of years, and that there's been a bit of a cover-up in the White House about the degree of his illness. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, I did an item pointing out when this big report came out, I think it was on the front page of the Times and a lot of other papers, that this drug Halcyon, it's the most popular sleeping pill in the country, and came out with a report that it causes hallucinations, lightheadedness, all sorts of terrible side effects. And I pointed out that a couple weeks earlier, when Bush collapsed in Japan, that it came out that he was a user of Halcyon. So I think that part of this might be that he's been taking these prescription pharmaceuticals, which are not.
Well, I heard that Secretary of State Baker, whom President Bush keeps on the diplomatic run, had taken it because he could not sleep on airplanes, and it is a very dangerous drug in that it literally knocks you out. You have no dreams, no memory. You go to sleep, and you essentially wake up. How do you feel about Bush's reelection chances? Do you think the economy is going to turn around and that he'll be the ultimate winner?
I think he will be, partly just because I think that after, you know, Desert Storm, unless there was a really bad, you know, domestic situation, if the economy was really terrible, then he'd be in trouble. But I think, as the way things are now, that people are reluctant to vote a guy out of office that they have some degree of trust in and picks a total unknown. And I think that you would have to say that any of the Democrats now, in terms of the general public, are pretty unknown. And, you know, unless you follow politics, you know, as a profession or something, these guys are completely, you just don't know where they stand. They all seem to say the same thing. It's hard to even separate one from the other.
Richard,
so I think that Bush will get reelected, but it is also disturbing how inarticulate he can be at handling questions at the press. And, you know, I mean, he talks in sentence fragments.
One thing that's fascinated me about the president is that he has a secretary, Sally Fitzgerald, who is a British woman in her mid-50s, who runs his schedule from dawn to dusk. And other than an article in the Village Voice in the early 80s, you almost never hear about her. Why is that?
She hasn't gone on a current affair.
I haven't done any tabloid television.
she can't sing in cabarets. No. I think that, you know, this is one of these sort of non-stories where there was rumors that this woman that was on his staff for like the past 20 years has been, had been his mistress at some point, or still is, but, you know, she's not going to talk. They don't have any compromising pictures of them aboard the monkey business or anything.
But supposedly her function is not a sexual or a liaison one. She basically runs his schedule and yet manages to keep out of the limelight altogether.
Well, as I mean, I think unless, you know, this Jennifer Flowers thing never would have happened unless she had made tapes. There has to be some evidence. And the Donna Rice thing wouldn't have happened unless there were reporters who were stationed right outside catching him leaving her apartment, or her leaving his apartment at 5 a.m. in the morning. You know, I think that with the lack of any evidence whatsoever, these stories deserve not to get written.
Well, it's funny, you know, in 1982, I think the Post reported that Bush had actually been fired upon when he was vice president, leaving a woman's house at 4 in the morning by a jealous lover, and that the White House staff bugged Larry Speaks, who was then President Reagan's press secretary, about it during the press conference, and that he refused to answer. And then, of course, during the Iran-Contra thing, there was a rumor that Bush had been in a car collision, that Al Haig had to rescue him so that he could make an appointment. Do you think that presidents naturally still have a kind of hardened cover against gossip and against the kind of things that Clinton has suffered?
Well, I think there is a power of the incumbency where there's probably more reluctance on the part of newsmen to report something which might damage the stature of America, you know, worldwide or something, in terms of, you know, you'd be much more, you know, eager to report a story about one of six Democratic candidates who are, you know, challenging, than a guy who's an incumbent who's already, you know, in office in the White House, maybe. But I think that a lot of these rumors are just completely bogus. I mean, you know, have you seen the stock market will jump 15 points one day on some report of, you know, the completely fictitious report?
How do you as a reporter distinguish between what's bogus and what's real? You handle hundreds of calls every day, people with their own agendas and motivations to publish things. Do you have a sixth sense which allows you to distinguish what's true from what isn't?
I do go by guts a little bit, but also the easiest thing to do is just to make a phone call. And usually I don't mess around trying to, you know, be devious or stuff. I just call the party, you know, that the story's about. And, you know, usually if it's true, they'll admit it. And usually if it's not true, they'll scream and protest or something.
And do your sources tend to be lower level people, campaign aides, workers and that kind of thing? Or are they more prominent people who actually appear in your column?
Well, you get sources all over, and some of the best sources, I don't even know who they are because they're anonymous. You know, some of the best sources are people who have an axe to grind, and they type a letter because they don't even want to have their handwriting traced, and they'll type it up 2 pages, single spaced or something, and put it in an envelope. And it's, you know, when you read the amount of detail there, and they know all the names, you start to realize that if this is bogus, it's an incredible amount of research went into to hatch this.
Yes, as an example, there's a prominent Wall Street investment banker who uses the moniker Robert Johnson, who's one of your sources.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us a bit about him.
I've had a source for many years who calls up. When he called up many years ago, he says, look, I can't give you my name, but I'll just say when I call that I'm your brother, Robert. And this guy's been giving me stories for years, and I have no idea who he is.
But what's his motivation? Just the thrill of the chase?
Well, I think also it's sort of, you know, it's sort of the easiest way. Sometimes if somebody's angry about something, or they don't like something that's been reported, or the government has put out some sort of a bogus press release or something. I mean, he was angry about this supposed embargo of Haiti, and I say supposed because he pointed out that the people in power in Haiti are controlling all the food that comes in. You know, there was supposed to be an embargo, so the only thing that we were going to send to Haiti was going to be foods, because we don't want to starve the people out. Well, this just made the people in power even more powerful, because they were controlling all the food. So instead of breaking, you know, or whatever this embargo was supposed to do, it wasn't going to do it because it just made the entrenched powers that be even more powerful.
Richard, what's the worst thing that Donald Trump has ever done to you?
He's lied to me.
Would you care to go into specifics about that?
I could tell you just the most recent one was he had a fight down in Atlantic City on Friday, and he said that Sylvester Stallone was going to be there and Don Johnson. And I knew that Sylvester Stallone wasn't going to be there because I talked to somebody out in California who was meeting him that afternoon.
How does Trump, who's living on the largesse of his bankers essentially from day to day, manage to stay in the news even though he's a complete financial failure?
I think it's effort.
Does he monitor your column daily? And have you started writing less about him and Ivana and Marla and the others in that
I think
particular
that
circus?
Everybody has tried to go through withdrawal. It's like cold turkey is impossible, but I think that he's obviously become less interesting as his business prospects have dwindled. But I mean, there are legitimate reasons to write about him. I mean, I find myself defending myself because I do occasionally write about him. And I mean, he does promote fights. He does own a hotel. He is a forceful advocate of various issues, mainly himself. And he has a very complicated love life, which makes things more interesting to the public. I mean, I get letters from people when I write about, like, Ivana or something, you know, we're big fans of Ivana, you know, can you tell me more about her boyfriend, Ricardo Mazzucchelli, you know.
Now, there were rumors that you once manufactured a boyfriend for Ivana Trump in your column. Any truth to that?
I don't think so. I mean, this was, you're talking about Manushir Kanlari.
That's correct.
Well, they claimed that
Iranian,
they met.
Right?
They claimed that they met after reading that that they were lovers in my column, that he went up to her and introduced himself as like, I'm the guy who's supposed to be your stud. But I don't know. That might be revisionist history.
Trump follows, though, the gossip columns on a day-to-day basis. Do you hear from him every day?
Oh, no, no way.
Not anymore.
I mean, it's mainly if he has something he's promoting, I think everybody hears from him. I mean, I saw it from monitoring the other columns for this fight. They had a big boxing match, Larry Holmes versus
Ray Mercer.
Ray Mercer, merciless Ray Mercer.
And Holmes won, which was a surprise.
But I saw that there was little items, you know, in Thursday and Friday in all the papers, just when they're selling, you know, getting people to decide whether they're going to go down to Atlantic City. And he had strategically placed items in various different columns.
It's funny, Richard Johnson, in reading your column and sometimes contributing to it, the items that get picked up by the national press. Earlier in the year, there was a big to-do about the movie Thelma and Louise, which you may remember starred Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis, and was considered to be the first female macho movie. And you ended up on a lot of television shows with your views about the movie. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that was one of these amazing things where I just sort of went to a movie by, you know, on impulse on a Sunday night, and then went into the office on Monday and wrote about it. And it was, I guess the movie had just come out on Friday and the reviews had come out, but really nobody had seen it. And I basically attacked the movie just because I thought it was sort of silly. And I guess I was sort of quotable or something, because suddenly I had all these TV stations calling up, and I think Time did it, Newsweek, People did it. And it started this whole, I think it was one of these slow days in the summer, you know, when nobody had anything to write about. And so it blew up into this whole feminist issue.
Well, you're too modest, but weren't you branded as kind of the male chauvinist?
Well, I had to take the role of this, the male chauvinist pig.
And
I said that the movie promoted armed robbery, assault, drinking, drunk driving, and gun ownership as exercises in raising consciousness.
And on your various television appearances, were you ever challenged by an ardent feminist to a fight or a boxing match after the appearance?
Well, we had a little fencing going on, but it was, I think, all in good fun. And I think that the it all helped the movie tremendously, I'm sure. The more controversy over it there was, the more tickets were sold.
Another story that you covered this year that created a lot of controversy concerned John Reed, the chairman of Citicorp. This was picked up by New York Magazine and other magazines and television shows as well. Brief us about that.
Well, basically, this is just a classic gossip story where you are told that the head of Citicorp, the biggest bank in the country, has fallen madly in love with the woman who was working as the flight attendant on his corporate jet. He has a Gulfstream 4. They have about five or six other jets as well. But
what's that joke they tell at Citicorp, that before you land, you have to bring your stewardess upright?
Put your seat belts on and put your flight attendant in an upright position.
Excuse me for interrupting.
So, so basically, I did that story, and it sort of caused a big stir in the financial community.
In New York Magazine last week, in Christopher Byron's article, the implication was that John Reed in this office at 399 Park Avenue is not really in control of things, that he had to clear the interview with underlings, and that he might be ousted. What do you think about that?
No, the feeling I got from reading that was that that the underlings were being too overprotective of their boss, and the boss was even unaware that this reporter was trying to get a hold of him. He's so well insulated by different layers of bureaucracy that he's not even aware that this financial writer was and he was tracking him down. I mean, he tracked him down to his house up in Greenwich. And was leaving notes on his door and stuff, you know.
Richard Johnson, it seems that we've been hearing about the same celebrities in New York for a long time, whether it be Madonna, Michael Jackson, Donald Trump, Ivana, etc., and the people are sick and tired of them. Are there any people on the horizon coming up in the next 10 years that might replace these worn-out people?
I would hope so, Charlie. I would really
hope
so.
But you can't name any names, can you?
Well, they're probably, I mean, it's like, who heard of Madonna when she was hanging around in nightclubs? Probably where you and I were.
That's true. I remember her from Danceteria when she was considered the loosest girl on the floor.
Yeah. Just looked like some girl who needed a bath.
What about Andrew Cuomo, the governor's son? Do you think he's going to be a comer in the political field?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say if John F. Kennedy Jr. started to run for anything, I think he would have a very easy time getting elected.
There's a rumor going around that he might replace Teddy Kennedy on the Senate ballot in Massachusetts in 94. Do you think he really has the political instincts of his father? He's never struck me that way.
I don't think he's ambitious enough. Having seen him, I think that he was not even really set on politics as a career. There were rumors for a while that he wanted to go into acting. He might be well-adjusted enough that he just wants to enjoy being JFK Jr. and not do anything. I don't know.
Do you think the Kennedys as a political force have been eclipsed by the Willie Smith trial and Kennedy business?
That cemented them even more as American royalty. I think that the way they rose up to the challenge of that trial and showed a solidarity within the family and the performance that Ted Kennedy gave on the stand, I thought was just incredibly good.
Do you think that the family colluded in lying about Patricia Bowman's screams on the lawn in Palm Beach? Do you think they all lied?
I don't think so. I think that she was sort of a wacko. And I think that the whole case, if it hadn't involved the Kennedys, it never would have been brought to trial. There was no physical evidence of any violence.
You know, it's funny. I heard that Patty had a crush on Willie for 2 years and had been actively pursuing him. But on that particular night, she went to ask him to dance. And he turned to her in a very arrogant Kennedy-esque style, said, "I don't dance with pigs." And then she kind of determined to get him because of that. Do you think there's any truth in that, that she was kind of a hellion on the loose?
Well, it didn't come out at the trial, Charlie. I don't know.
Well, as we know from the Robert Chambers case, when the poor girl Jennifer Levin was murdered in Central Park, often the truth doesn't come out in a trial, and the prosecution and the defense will agree on parameters before it happens. In that case, the key piece of evidence was that Jennifer Levin's earrings were missing. And I had heard, at least, that he was rifling her possessions and jewelry for money to exchange for drugs, and that when she discovered him, he turned on her and killed her. But do you find in these big trials like the Tyson trial that there are limits?
Well, I think getting back to the Willie Smith trial, I think it's pretty clear that some sort of a deal was made where the prosecution would not get into the drinking that was going on by the Kennedys on that particular
and the drug usage.
And I think that there was probably a trade-off, because I think that probably the defense had an inkling that maybe Patricia Bowman had been doing some drugs that night, and the Kennedys obviously had been doing some drinking that night. So I think that there was a deal made where the defense goes, well, we won't get into her taking drugs if you lay off of us about the drinking, because you didn't hear any testimony about that. It was so obvious. If you're going to be prosecuting this guy for rape, you should, you know, make it sound like he's just a raving drunken maniac.
Carolyn Kennedy just signed a $500,000 contract with her partner to write a second book after her book on the Bill of Rights. Do you think she really writes any of the words in her own books?
I don't know. I think the fact that you're raising it, though, is now making me wonder.
I mean, Profiles in Courage was written by Ted Sorensen, Jack Kennedy's speechwriter, and Jack never even saw the book until it was published, and he won a Pulitzer for it.
Do you think that Senator Al Gore wrote that book about ecology that just came out?
No way. No way. But it raises a larger question, and that is the influence of the Kennedy family within the publishing industry, within journalism. Do they actually have journalists and agents and publishing types under their control?
I don't think it's that clear. I just think that there are people who have the same ideology. I mean, if you listen to Pat Buchanan, the whole media is completely dominated by left-wingers and liberals of, that would be of the Kennedy ilk. And so, I don't think that it's a question where they're like on the payroll or something. It's just that I think that there has been, the Kennedys have wielded incredible influence because of their connections in Boston and, the whole Harvard mafia. I think Dukakis was maybe the last gasp of the Kennedy empire building, and it failed miserably, but they're reforming now. You never know what's going to happen 4 years from now.
Who's to say that Paul Zongas isn't receiving some funding from them? Because he's certainly linked with Kennedy-linked corporations in Cambridge, microchip software, that kind of thing.
Well, then he'll be their second last gasp.
Richard, what about the future of the Daily News? It's been a rocky road working there for the last year. Jim Wilsey, the new publisher and editor, is a seasoned newspaper person. He seems to be in control. I see you putting on your Daily News button.
Yes.
What does that say?
These are buttons they've been distributing for a couple weeks. It says, "Too tough to die." Now, basically, the news, I think the thing that's going to save the news is that there's so much fat there. There's so much inefficiency and mismanagement that's become part of the organization over the 70 years or so, that they can keep cutting and cutting away. We're marginally unprofitable, and then to become marginally profitable, it's like you just have to cut a little bit, so they can just keep sort of whittling away and keeping us sort of break even.
Is the paper actively looking for a buyer? Is that the way it's going to be rescued?
We're not even actively looking now. I think that the process, that we're in Chapter 11 now, which is a, it's like Bloomingdale's just came out of it. So that proves that it's not fatal, And Macy's just went into it. But I think what happened is that, what it immediately allows you to do is we've been paying double the rent per square foot that's the market. We've been paying double market rent. So immediately when you're in Chapter 11, you can go to the landlord and say, hey, we're in bankruptcy, and it's all open for renegotiation. So we expect to save $6 million right there just on rent.
Finally, Richard Johnson, I think the big media story in the 90s is going to be the changes in the New York Times. Pinch Sulzberger has just succeeded his father as publisher. There are rumors that there's a full-color plant in Edison, New Jersey, ready to go, and you might see a full-color New York Times, if you can believe that. And they might even be hiring a gossip columnist.
I hadn't heard that, but I think it's a good idea.
They've been floating the rumor that, the Times seems to be worried about appealing to younger audiences because in the surveys they've done, only 10% of the people between the ages of 18 and 34 even know what the New York Times is in New York City. And this is a big concern of Pinch's. Do you think the Times will finally change its identity and get with the times, so to speak?
Well, I think there's a certain, cachet to resisting change, like the Wall Street Journal, they refuse to use photographs to this day. And I think that there's something to be said for that. The New Yorker won't use photographs. But I think that at a certain point, they realized they already revamped their sports section. And the Washington Post just started a new gossip column. So I'm encouraged by that. It shows that they can coexist with Bob Woodward.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Richard Johnson, for being my guest. I'd like to thank you all for putting up with our little chat. And let's do it again. Dinner is upstairs.
Had a couple laughs.
Oh yeah, more than a few. You were great.